Hi everyone, welcome to another of our virtual ILS Asia 2021 event broadcasts. Please do visit the event website to see the details of our kind sponsors and also to view the agenda, and you can find links there to the on-demand content from previous sessions as well. So we continue to update you on ILS activity and opportunities in the Asia region, all under our theme of expanding market access and opportunities. And for this broadcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Corey Anger, Managing Director at GC Securities. Thanks for joining me today, Corey.
Thank you, Steve, for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Great to see you. So for this interview, we're going to discuss the Asian catastrophe bond and ILS market and ask what's next. So we're going to ask you to get your crystal ball out and tell us what's coming down the pipeline without giving away any client secrets. We've seen development of ILS domiciles. Now we have two of them in the region, Singapore and also Hong Kong. And so the region's becoming a home to transactions, but we're going to discuss how transactions are being received by investor base, the importance of cultivating the regional sponsor community as well, and the opportunity to grow Asia's ILS market more broadly and what the drivers could be to sustain that growth, I guess, too. So, Corey, we've seen increasing traction in Singapore since its ILS regulatory regime was released. So far, seven transactions, I believe, have been issued out of Singapore this year, up on last year's six. So is this aligned with the levels of activity you'd expected for the domicile?
Yes, I would. The level of activity in Singapore is just commensurate with the overall increased activity that's going on in the ILS market, as we saw in the first half of 2021. Through the first half of 2021, we've seen $7.9 billion of capital raised through 27 distinct transactions. That represents 26 sponsors, and then they had 47 different classes of notes that were offered through those 27 distinct transactions. And if you compare that to the first half of 2020, we had 27 transactions, which is the same number as what we've had this year, 25 sponsors, so one less sponsor, and through 46 specific classes of notes that were offered in the transaction. So the fact that we're seeing Singapore get that commensurate share of the transactions doesn't surprise me at all, just given the increased activity overall. And I would expect them to continue to be getting their commensurate share and potentially maybe accelerate it, given that the ILS grant reimbursement program is scheduled to come to an end on December 31st, 2022. So I would think that there might be sponsors, if they haven't yet utilized the market anywhere or would contemplate changing, there might be an acceleration. And so we might see an expansion in the interim, unless Singapore extends their grant program, potentially with changes, but unless they extend it, there could be a rush to get access to that program.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, actually. People could try to take advantage of that before it changes or disappears, I suppose. But yeah, it's been a very busy half year. I'm sure very busy for your team as well. But this year, we also, well, actually, towards the end of last year, we also saw the first sidecar issued out of Singapore as well. And do you think we'll see more of that kind of transaction?
We do. And in fact, there's been a lot of dialogue, at least on the GC Securities platform, that we've had with clients about using Singapore for sidecar type of transactions. So we were excited to see this first sidecar. As I understand, it benefited MS Amlin. I believe you first reported it in December. And we have had sponsor interest in wanting to utilize Singapore for sidecar deals. However, the requirements for accessing the ILS grant reimbursement and the regulatory structure for sidecars are still evolving in Singapore. And so, for example, most sidecars that are currently being done, typically using Bermuda vehicles, have a 12 to 18 month risk period, which would be outside of making it grant eligible in Singapore. And I think the sponsors that have been interested in setting it up, and new sponsors actually that I think could bring Asia Pacific risk in a sidecar fashion, have interest, but it's the minimum 3 year risk period makes it more challenging on the with the sidecar structures. And this is because investors prefer in the sidecar structures, you're taking a slice of the program of all perils, but they want to have more frequent ability to revisit their commitment in a sidecar facility, and they want to evaluate it against the loss performance over that 12 to 18 months. So that's why we don't see as much duration in our sidecar structures as you would see in a typical cat bond. However, you know, we've had a number of kind of informal conversations with MAS even before this transaction that happened late last year. And we understand that MAS has been evaluating sidecar structures and the grant scheme to enable such type of products. And, you know, subject to the results of their study, I think there could be good interest in utilizing Singapore SPRVs for those type of products.
It would be an interesting expansion, particularly with sponsors from the region, if more of those could come to the market and look for diversification in their reinsurance programs that way. Because many of the sponsors so far are obviously from outside Asia, and that's clearly a function of the grant program being available right now and very attractive. But what do you think it will take to develop the regional sponsor base?
Well, I think there's a couple things. First, we have to understand how much risk is seeded in general around the world. And most risk comes from North America. We seed more risk than anywhere else in the world. We buy more insurance than anywhere else in the world. And so insurance penetration rates play a role into how much risk is available and then needs to be seeded. The second piece of it is how valued is a scarcer risk in a portfolio and how it prices. And so, you know, given the limit needs and the scarcity risk, the traditional market has done a great job of capturing and retaining this risk. Probably the area where you see the most concentration of risk given insurance penetration has been in Japan, and that is our most frequent zone where we see ILS transactions being used, with pockets being elsewhere in the Asia Pacific region. So price is a huge component of people contemplating utilizing the ILS market, and continuing to recognize the scarcity value of some of the risks in the Asia Pacific region is something that's important that ILS investors need to maintain that understanding of scarcity so that we can continue to attract that risks. What I do think is very helpful is the grant reimbursement program has been, I think, instrumental and key in getting Singapore's ecosystem for ILS up and running. You know, before that, people may have had some knowledge, but we didn't have a wealth of service providers in the region and a wealth of knowledge. And I think that we applaud that commitment of MAS for such approach. And I think it's also allowed folks like GC Securities and Guy Carpenter to get more comfortable to say that we understand the process very well in that region. And so by virtue of us understanding and have had positive experience, it allows us to then promote the jurisdictions in the region that are looking to expand that footprint. And that promotion into the sponsors will then help them consider and bring more risk out to the ILS market. I do think that expanding the type of vehicles that can be used, whether we're talking about Singapore and obviously Hong Kong is the more recent entrance, I think that will be helpful in expanding the application for some of these regional sponsors. Whether it be sidecars or the use of segregated cell vehicles.
And of course, the segregated cell could also be interesting for the investor side as well, to start seeing some activity in this region from dedicated investors with vehicles set up. But yes, you mentioned Hong Kong, and obviously that's now readying itself for the first cat bond transaction, as we reported recently. So there's another welcome option for possible sponsors from places like China, as well as the rest of the world. And there's another grant scheme available too. So are you hearing of appetite from sponsors to use Hong Kong for ILS issuance?
Well, we do. We would expect there could be, you know, several deals executed before the end of the year. Both the Chinese regulator and the Hong Kong Insurance Authority have been very supportive of sponsors using a Hong Kong special purpose reinsurer for an ILS deal, whether it's through the grant scheme, whether it's working them through the regulatory approval process. They have shown the commitment by offering the incentive grant reimbursement scheme. They want to make this a success. And I think they're starting first with companies that haven't yet brought as much risk to the ILS market, which is Chinese insurers and reinsurers. And so I think that's particularly exciting, because that's really going to expand Asia risks that are available to the ILS market. We have, you know, again, Japan tends to be our most concentrated Asia Pacific risk that's offered. We may have some index triggered transactions that would give us exposure to the Australia market and now New Zealand with the introduction of the indices there. But I think it's very exciting what they're doing, and in particularly supporting China to be ceding risk outwards out of the country. It'll help risk takers understand the risk better, but also should be promoting more capital support in the Asia Pacific region out of being sourced from the ILS market.
Yeah, no, you mentioned there that the first one looks set to come from a Chinese reinsurer. And I was going to ask, do you think Hong Kong will have to also sort of look to US sponsors and foreign sponsors to really build up the sort of groundswell of experience and activity there, as Singapore has done? But it sounds like perhaps they have a bit of a head start with the relationship with mainland China.
I think that they have a unique relationship that allows them to work with a sponsor base and facilitating them out in the market. They don't necessarily need to look to the international markets. With that being said, I think they've been very open. They've worked with experienced service providers as consultants from globally and setting up their frameworks so that there is the possibility of foreign sponsors utilizing, you know, a Hong Kong special purpose reinsurer. You know, I think a key thing for investors is also just making sure that they're comfortable with the requirements of Hong Kong. Sponsors also comfortable, you know, whether we see governing law or any tax issues that are specific and unique out of interacting with a Hong Kong special purpose reinsurer. And I think that they've been trying to be very thoughtful of that. And I think the grant scheme is meant to help manage any aspects that there might be. You know, we have seen, you know, other jurisdictions where they put on very specific requirements, such as like it must be the local governing law to enable our transactions. And that actually starts to limit foreign sponsors from coming in. I don't see the actions that the Hong Kong AA has been doing Hong Kong Insurance Authority has been doing in implementing its guidelines for the special purpose reinsurers. They're not doing anything that I think would prohibit it. And I think that that's a positive. They've listened to all of the consultants, intermediaries, and folks that want to help them have a functioning jurisdiction that's available, not just for mainland China, but also for the broader international community.
Yeah, no, it sounds like the ILS community has worked quite closely with both Singapore and Hong Kong in getting their sort of frameworks and regimes up and running and making sure that it happens in the right way as well, which is positive. It's good to see the industry supporting choice as well. Now, both of them have obviously ambitions to establish protected cell structures and to encourage collateralized reinsurance as well as cat bonds and other things. But do you think the Asian sort of cedent base is mature enough when it comes to ILS to look to utilize a more locally domiciled structure? And I guess I'm thinking about whether they could establish their own third-party capital vehicles locally, perhaps in the future.
I do think that it's important to be encouraging and to enable those type of vehicles, because even if it's not the sponsor setting up this fronting vehicle or an investor setting up a fronting vehicle, by virtue of having a fronting vehicle, you know, I talked about that the pricing is very critical in the Asia Pacific region to be competitive to enable these transactions. And so to have a cost efficient jurisdiction where you can facilitate capital to come in and take potentially a smaller line, not every Asia Pacific region cedent needs at least 100 million of limit that they want to cede into the ILS market, but allowing someone to come in and take a 1 million, a 2 million, a 10 million line on a program, I think is particularly important. And so I do believe that they should continue on focusing it. You know, Singapore has been analyzing, I think, longer, given that it's had its cap on ILS regulatory structure in place for a number of years, and it now has the experience of all of the transactions that they've been doing since 2018. And I think there's been a number of inquiries from intermediaries and sponsors about expanding into collateralized and sidecars that I think there's enough strong enough effort that they'll get there. It's when you're sequencing to step into the ILS market, you go with kind of the structures that are the most standardized and easiest to implement. And you have to be very thoughtful with the segregated cell structures of how to implement it within your regime, but also, you know, make it work and how it could be applied. And so I think there's just, there are broader applications that we've seen some of the segregated cell vehicles used for. And I think they just want to be prudent in their evaluation of how to implement it. I think Hong Kong is also focused on those type of vehicles. But again, when you start, when you want to start with ILS, you're going to go with the more basic structure. And so it's a little bit simpler to implement the CAPONs in order to establish the flow in your jurisdiction, gain experience, and then you'll pivot to expanding those ILS structures. I also think it'll be important to have the proper service providers available for those expanding structures. You may see some differences in the services that are needed to be offered in whether it's a segregated cell vehicle or a sidecar vehicle versus what you have in a CAPON structure. And so, again, I think laying the groundwork from starting with the basic structure of the CAPON and then building from that, to me, seems like the prudent way to go.
Yes. And what about the ILS fund managers? I mean, most of their representation in Asia is really on the marketing side. But do you think you could see them establishing structures in Asian domiciles in years to come?
Well, what's going to be key for them in utilizing, and particularly if I talk about a segregated cell vehicle, is that the investor typically bears that transformation cost out of the premium that they get paid on the traditional placement, because they're just sitting typically side by side. Maybe they've carved out a special layer, but typically they're side by side with the traditional market. So they are incredibly sensitive to cost structures that are take too much of the economics of the overall premium that they're getting paid. In the same way that a market may decide, do I go with a rated fronted reinsurer and the leverage that I get from them, versus this rate online opportunity, is it better for me to use a non-rated fund and fully collateralize it? So they're making that economic decision, and given that the margins are thinner and relative to the risk profile in the Asia Pacific region, they can be more sensitive to the cost structure of these vehicles. So I think it's really important that that they can be efficient for them. You know, a number of the providers of these type of structures, whether it's somebody like Guy Carpenter, we have our Isosceles platform, and, you know, our competitors have their own platform versus third parties that are standalone and providing these services. They can obviously use that versus build it on their own versus use a rated fund. Efficiency is important for us when we're looking at a domicile, not just also the investor.
Absolutely. And so lastly, while we're thinking about the sort of the platform that's developing in Asia, obviously the grant schemes, as we've been saying, have really been critical in attracting sponsors to begin with and continue to be. But obviously they are going to wind down eventually or evolve into something slightly different perhaps. So what do you think these regional issuance hubs are going to have to do to stay relevant globally as those benefits erode or are removed?
Yeah, so I think it's two things. Experience with renewing issuances in a jurisdiction, not just the first issuance. So we kind of need to test the waters on that and how people feel comfortable in it. I think, and service providers hate to hear this. I'm a service provider, so I hate to hear it, but having a cost-effective ecosystem. If you are a more expensive jurisdiction and a client is agnostic, meaning this jurisdiction A offers the same benefits as they see it and the same access to the capital as jurisdiction B, then it's the friction of the costs that are involved. As you know, and all of this is assuming that you've passed the kind of regulatory test and investor comfort test. We actually saw this in the case where, in the early days of the ILS market, the Cayman Islands was a lot more efficient, both cost and process, in setting up special purpose reinsurers. So virtually all of the CAPONs were done out of Cayman. And the BMA recognizing this and making some adjustments in their model, all of a sudden, all of that flow moved from the Cayman Islands to Bermuda because they became operationally easy to deal with and cost effective to deal with. And so I'm sure none of these jurisdictions want to hear that they have to compete against each other, particularly on their cost of whether it be the regulatory capital for the share capital of the vehicle, but just all of the service providers build around that if the load is too much or the requirements of setting it up and maintaining it become more burdensome, what you will see is people will shift to, you know, other jurisdictions that are just easy to deal with. Sometimes it's a time element. So I do want to think there are sponsors that we have that need Solvency II compliant jurisdictions, and that limits where they can look at. So to the extent that any jurisdiction can compete with that, I think is actually sets you out as a differentiator because there's a limited group of folks that can provide that. But you need to think about what differentiates you in a positive way. Make sure your differentiator isn't a negative necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's shift over to sort of the investor side of the market. And obviously now with ILS, I guess, gaining in promotion in the Asia region, thanks to activity in Singapore and now Hong Kong, clearly people in China and investors in China are probably hearing about it a lot more. Do you hear of or do you expect to see an expansion of the ILS investor base in Asia as a result of this?
Yeah, I think actually both regulatory regimes are hoping that it will untap capital, given just the prominence of Singapore and Hong Kong as leaders in capital pools, and just the size of their pools have been growing as the Asia Pacific region has developed so rapidly over the last 10, 20 years. It's not something you can't ignore, this pool of capital. And so I think they would like to see it come in and support the insurance and risk transfer space overall. And everybody talks about closing the protection gap. Well, one way to do it is bringing in new capital as well. So I know that both regulatory entities have focused on it. Singapore has sponsored events where they've tried to come help educate investors in the space. And I would say that it's a question of how that money is going to actually flow into the sector. I think all of those conversations are helpful to get people thinking about how to invest in whether they're comfortable investing, but it's a whether you're going to have an investor step over and say, I will directly invest in the space, or I'm going to say, I'm comfortable with the attributes of the space, but I still want someone that's experienced to navigate us through that. And I think if you look at the complexion of the investor base, that if you looked over 20 years, you've seen a radical change in the complexion of the investor base. Early days of the market, it was, five key markets and a ton of tiny markets. And you had more weighting on hedge funds. Now you don't have that focus. And so really, when we look at the core investors that are making the decision of whether they want to assume that risk, it's coming from our dedicated ILS managers with some of the direct, historical pension funds and money managers that we've seen, but we really haven't seen like a large new investor step in and say, I'm going to directly start writing this. So it may be implicit that we're seeing this capital flow in, but it's flowing in through some of the existing sources. One of the things I can say is that, the concentration of capital among the top 10 has been expanding. So that's a good thing to see, that we're not seeing it being, it's only two or three that have most of the capital. While your massive transaction comes from probably your top 10, top 12 investors, you are seeing some of the middle-sized investors actually get larger. And we would hope that the efforts that are being done in this region, they're seeing the benefits of that.
Absolutely. And when we think about Asian institutional investor community, there's a huge focus on ESG there, particularly in some of the markets like Japan. And it's seen as a particularly important point for allocators there. And they're making some very big commitments to invest responsibly as well. Now, obviously, ESG is a huge trend in the ILS market and insurance more broadly. But do you think this could be a bit of an opportunity for stimulating growth of Asian ILS if people can find ways to connect and make these instruments sustainable and qualify as an ESG-friendly asset?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when you first looked at ESG how it started was small pools of money, but they were promoting ESG principles through disinvestment. And now radically, you can see those pools of money have dramatically increased. I think the recognition from some constituencies that we believe there is climate change and there is an effect of climate change. And we can be a contributor in from a private sector, not relying on the public sector to make the decision of how to manage it, but the private sector to guide industries to be more green and clean and ESG focused. You've just seen more focused pools of money, and they're just gaining more mass. And I think there was a directive in Europe in March that has caused almost all money managers to start focusing on this topic. We had seen a small number of investors were starting to ask, as long as, you know, 3 years ago, were starting to ask some very basic ESG questions. Some of which are, you know, like they're taking questionnaires that are used in the recourse financing market, which is very different from an insurance risk transfer market. And they're asking some of those same questions. We can answer them, but I do think that there needs to be an element of, are these the right questions we should be asking about ESG and the insurance and the reinsurance space? Listen, there are some that will say that we're already, that supporting insurance and reinsurance is already consistent with ESG principles. But I don't think the ESG money wants to rely upon that statement. They want to see go further that as a result of their investment, that they are reshaping how this capital is supporting supporting insurance and reinsurance. And I think one example of that is in Generali's recent Lion 3 cap bond, where they renewed some existing protection that they cap on based protection. And in this case, it was for Europe windstorms and Italian earthquake. You know, they have, they are in my mind, one of the innovators and leaders in the insurance and the reinsurance space in trying to promote ESG principles. First, it starts from a corporate perspective, and they had already done recourse financings through green bonds, but then they didn't stop there. They expanded that and laid out a framework that's public and available on their website with respect to ILS. And then they said, well, when we use ILS, we're going to implement our framework into that. And I think that we saw a resounding response, positive response from investors in the efforts that they were doing. You know, I think what it does is, one, it opens up to ESG investors that may only be on the recourse financing side and may not be on the risk transfer side to start to think about, is this a place where ESG pools of capital could expand into? In addition to the concerted, the coordinated efforts, I think that ILS money managers are doing, where they're seeing increased capital allocations coming from ESG funds. And so for them, seeing a transaction like this is very helpful. They're, you know, if some investors are scoring every single transaction based on the ESG principles in order that they can show to the ESG funds that this is a place where your money can be implemented. And I think we're very bullish on that step that, and it's a key step that I think Generali has made in building a green cap on in a way that no other sponsor has done to date. They have committed that the freed up capital from the transaction will be either on the asset side of their balance sheet, invested only into green investments, but also could be used for promotion of furthering green products within the insurance industry. And I think that very much resonated. It wasn't just an investment approach, but it was also how is Generali as a company and offering products could be a promoter of that. And then I think that the work that they did with the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development, where not just, you know, because I think a lot of people would say, well, isn't EBRD necessarily ESG compliant because they're, you know, helping all these countries, you know, be stable, but develop their economies in the right way. Well, they've actually gone further that even within the initiatives of EBRD, they're allocating it to specific green projects so that they're accelerating not just the stability of what the development work that they do, but they're supporting the green development that the bank is doing. And nobody has done it in the same way that they're doing it. And you know, all of this is proved out by the fact that we had just resounding performance on the Lion 3 bond, where it sets an all-time market low for the margin that was paid in excess of the expected loss. That that shouldn't be lost on any sponsor. They were rewarded for their efforts. You know, existing ILS investor feedback to Generali has been, you know, strongly supporting their efforts. And, you know, I think that we think that that is going to be the basis for looking at ESG framework to be and potentially build upon that in ILS structures going forward. It would not surprise us if you see many folks starting to reduplicate what Generali has done. And then it will be interesting to see who builds on that base that Generali has set. But, you know, in our experience, having placed the deal, the investors were very, very happy to see the efforts that Generali did with making the structure ESG compliant.
No, that's really good to hear. I was going to ask, I mean, you mentioned there it's maybe a baseline or a basis for building on top of. And I was going to ask, do you think that goes far enough for the large ESG allocators of the world? I mean, I've spoken to end investors who ask, so how do we know where all of the insurance payments go to that this bond is going to support if it pays out? And there's some ESG allocators seem to be incredibly focused on minute detail within transactions. I mean, it's quite a lot of work for the ILS market to get to somewhere like that, but do you think there's enough interest and sort of motivation to do that? Or to try?
I do think there is. And frankly, given the volume of questionnaires that we get on the ESG side from investors for every single deal, so every deal that we've placed this year, we've gotten some ESG questionnaires from a segment of the investors that in order that they capture the information and then they're reporting it back to their in-source money. But we want to have a hand in shaping that because some of the questions are very difficult. So I had a client very recently. So it was asking the question, do you provide coverage to companies that manufacture palm oil? Well, you know, how does a regional carrier in the US who might write to a convenience store property coverage that sells palm oil, do we need to link it down that far? You know, where do we stop in the evaluation of this? So I've had a lot of questions about how to answer the questions that are being posed to them. And clearly there's some that just don't even fit them because of their regional focus, as opposed to being a kind of a global carrier. But I think it's something that we've seen so much of the questions and how we want sponsors to support it. I think you'll start to see that folks like GC Securities are going to be engaging more with the investors on crafting this out and understanding where we can take this in the next, you know, what the next iteration is going to be.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear as well. I mean, it does seem that it's going to be a sort of a long road to becoming ESG compliant in all allocators' view for the asset class, particularly when you think of retrocession and the visibility that would be required beneath those portfolios. And how do you get that when it's an industry loss trigger? But it's great to hear that the industry seems to be keen to move in that direction with the support of people like yourselves. So when we think about sort of ILS market activity this year, I thought it was worth talking about because we're pretty much on record pace for the year again, I think, if activity levels remain the same. And I hear that interest is as strong and investors seem to have interest from their end investors as well, the fund managers do. So it's been particularly busy in the first half. I mean, what do you think the driver has been this year? Is it just additional appetite for diversified protection, or is it inflows of capital into UCITS cap bond funds, for example, which I know some have grown considerably?
So what makes a good marketplace is obviously that we have access to capital to start there. And so last year and this year have been high maturity years where the products that we placed 3 and 4 years ago are now coming up for renewal. And to the extent that they haven't been utilized in the structure, it creates natural cash to be reinvested. And that's keeps a positive tone. I think what's more interesting is the capital that's been coming in, augmenting that addition, you know, that already baseline capital in the space that is coming up for maturity. I think when you look at the three segments of ILS between sidecars, collateralized reinsurance, and cap bonds, investors have been attracted to the fact that the cap bond space has demonstrated liquidity through times of capital market stress. And I can't reiterate how much investors saw that yet again after the financial crisis was a big catalyst, but last year was another where during March and April, where the initial reaction to the impact of COVID, investors are trying to figure out, what does this mean? How do I pivot my capital around what COVID is going to do to the market? Doesn't mean I'm going to take away from ILS, but maybe I need to change that. And do I have that ability in the illiquid structures? I think loss performance, you know, we were already starting to see fatigue around the unexpected losses that kept seeping in, probably a little bit disproportionately in the sidecar market, but also you would see it in the collateralized remarket. Whereas the cap on market, when you looked back at the kind of long-term advertised expected loss versus the performance of the losses, and there have been losses and they have paid out on those losses, but they've been more consistent with each other. And so that consistency plus liquidity has attracted more capital to say, I'd rather focus right now on the cap on market. And we know it's a pendulum. We know that given how rates move, that capital may move into other segments. If we soften too much, that it might migrate out of the cap on market and they'll start to reach for more yield and return by going into the illiquid structures. But as of right now, the catalyst really has been on the cap on market. And so when you have this points, what I find interesting is they pay attention to the how the traditional market views risk, but their cost of capital is benchmarked in their view differently than how a reinsurer looks at its cost of capital and the return that it needs. It doesn't need to generate that equity return. And so with spreads actually pretty tight, interest rates pretty low, they're looking at it versus other asset classes in the traditional capital markets. And even with the pricing levels having gone down to probably back to 2018 levels, we're getting close to that, you can see that the investor base is saying this still offers value to me relative to the other traditional capital markets investments I could consider. And the fact that there's low correlation in the performance of this space to the traditional capital markets keeps me captive to this space. So it's kind of like a replay of what we saw in 2011 and 2012. And then I would say again in 2016 and 2017, where the ILS market was happy to adjust its pricing levels more quickly than maybe the traditional market was. Now, with that being said, you know, it's not always the case. We saw in March and April of 2020 after COVID that the capital markets said, I need to increase my pricing. I need to adjust for the risk that we're seeing in the system and the comparative returns that I can get on other products. Whereas the traditional market was initially saying, well, I don't think I have much of an impact. And actually it was a more slow burn for them to recognize that, wait, I do have exposures that are coming in that were unanticipated or a larger magnitude than I would have expected. And so what we saw is a slower response on the traditional side to increase its pricing. And I think just the capital markets takes a faster view when it makes premium changes. And so when you have that faster view is opportunities for sponsors. At the same time, what you have is, you know, we've seen startups in the traditional reinsurer market, but we don't see the whole class of, you know, 2001, like a large influx of capital. It's many of the same providers recapitalizing, but trying to be prudent so that they can figure out how to deploy it. And I think, based on, you know, capital and influx of that capital, that's where you can get different views of risk on pricing. So, you know, kind of a long answer to your question, and I'll kind of tie this all back together, which is, pricing is a big catalyst for this market, for capital come in. But then the second piece of it is as my program is expanding, so if I look at my model loss costs and if I'm looking at replacement value increases, but also building material increases, that has a huge impact into how much limit I may need to buy from a regulatory perspective or rating agency perspective. At what point do they say, listen, if I kept my limit within this realm, maybe I'm fine with my existing slate of panel providers, but now that I'm reaching outside of it, what I'm concerned about is I'm not going to be able to keep the same pricing that I'm getting on the rest of the program. And that becomes a catalyst when folks say, let me think about whether I can diversify and expand out the counterparties that are providing this so that I'm not stretching within the existing counterparties and asking them for more expensive limit, just simply because they may be as we are a counterparty to them, we may be, they may be at their limits with us. The other third place where I see why it's been so active and why you see new sponsors is also just the claims performance. There is a recognition from some clients that they have very large lines from traditional reinsurers, and COVID exposed concerns about willingness to pay, not ability to pay. They certainly have the ability to pay, but the willingness to pay. And do they want to keep taking such concentration of exposure to counterparties where they have that exposure? And does diversifying some of that with other counterparties take away that concentration? So those are really the three reasons that we've seen a very active first half, and we think it's going to continue to be active. I mean, if you look over the next 12 months from here, we have almost $9.5 billion of limit that's going to mature. So the market attributes are going to remain, in my opinion, positive unless we have some external impact to the system, which could be very much loss activity, can change tone. But right now, these three elements are driving why clients are going to use it. But, price is a very important piece of this. And that's, I think, again, how the ILS market has been viewing what is adequate pricing has been helpful to encourage sponsors and new sponsors to come to the market.
I mean, if you're talking about spreads being down almost at sort of 2018 levels, do you think that's going to help stimulate more issuance for the second half of this year?
I do. And you can even see that in some of the issuance that came up in the second quarter. I think clients started to say, hang on a minute, maybe I do want to look at this. And I think that those that thought, well, I'm good enough, may actually want to think about, how do I build in that tension into my program? And that's become an important part. A lot of the clients that I service, I do in conjunction with our Guy Carpenter broking team that works with that client, and they are seeing real time. We are real time placing it, and we are having real time discussions about what is the right mix between ILS and the traditional market, and how we can use this together to really build that kind of lattice very well for our clients. So these are, important decisions that our clients are living with potentially for multi-year term. On the ILS side, we want to make sure that we get that mix right in attracting the strongest program for them.
Yeah, that's really encouraging to hear, because if I think back sort of 15 odd years or so when the cat bond market was just developing, I would often speak to sponsors who've had a disconnect between the capital markets placements and their traditional placements, and there wasn't that cohesive working together to get the best pricing, the best mix of capital, the best diversification a sponsor really needs. So it's great that we've now matured the industry far enough that that's actually becoming a driver for people as well. Very encouraging. One of the things that we've seen in sort of the last couple of years, I suppose, is a range of sponsors who seem to be looking for something a little more than just, they're not looking for reinsurance or retrocession. They're insurance buyers, but they're buying something that's contingent on a bad event happening to them, often on a parametric basis, sometimes accessing the market and issuing cat bonds using captives or their own structures or with the help of a reinsurer. Do you think this is a trend that's going to continue? I mean, I think we've probably discussed this at an event in the past about sort of corporate issuers and things, but particularly with climate risk becoming incredibly important and people being asked to value climate exposure within their assets, whether they're investment portfolios or holdings or physical assets. Do you think this is a trend that's going to be coming to the cat bond market and coming to ILS?
I do. I think that, again, the use of ILS in the corporate space is a little more sensitive to where is even probably even more sensitive to pricing, because they don't wiggle as much in pricing when bad things happen. It's kind of like a a tail on a dog, the end of the tail, which is akin to our reinsurers, when that tail really gets moving, they really feel the impact of it. You know, at the corporate market or consumer market, you're really at the base of the tail where you feel some wiggle, but it's not as wide of there's not as much volatility in the moving of pricing. And so extreme price sensitivity, but I think that one of the things that's very interesting is people will talk about, you know, we've seen more indemnity corporate transactions actually come, which is kind of interesting as well. But when we talk about parametric transactions, some will say, well, but I'm taking on basis risk. Would they fail to kind of recognize? And I think even COVID has shown this in some of the policies of you thought you had coverage for this when in fact you didn't, because you maybe needed a direct physical loss. We didn't have that direct physical loss. This wasn't to provide you, you know, business interruption and any scenario that you had to close. So I think that even when you look at an indemnity coverage, you have basis risk in those coverages based on what's excluded and your sublimits. And so I think the recognition of one, what risks am I taking on and how can I hedge that risk and speed of payment is something that's become more important for some clients. Now, some of these clients, they have a tremendous access to capital. They generate tremendous earnings. So maybe, you know, you would say, do you need to do something that, you know, of this magnitude? But I think that the requirements in reporting on climate change and the impact of climate change probably is starting to say, okay, these are risks that we hadn't identified before. Is this something that we want to think about hedging versus, you know, retaining on our side? But I don't see any abating of that segment of the market. And in fact, I think we've seen more activity continue to expand over the last 5 years and are very encouraged by it.
I think it's an interesting area of the market and one potentially that Asia could also see activity in, given the extreme cat risks there and the large valued corporations who probably don't buy the level of insurance traditionally that we would in the States or in Europe. But I guess finally, I'll ask you to sort of look ahead to the rest of this year and could just what are your feelings for the sort of cat bond market through the rest of this year? Are we going to break those records? Otherwise in ILS, do you think it's all dependent on the hurricane season?
I don't actually think it's dependent on the hurricane season. I think we've got a lot of capital that can naturally mature that makes it interesting. Apologies, my phone's in the background. And so I think that that will keep the market activity going by the fact of just how well things have been pricing and with that kind of natural capital release, I think you're going to see activity continue to be strong. The one thing I will say that will be interesting is that over the last 18 months, we've seen a lot of reinsurers and a lot of reinsurers who hadn't previously utilized the ILS market access the market. And so that's been a bigger contribution of the total issuance that's been done. I think with a number of those having already locked in protections, we may not see as much contribution from the reinsurer side. So it'll be a question of where that issuance comes from. But I think the discussions that we have with sponsors that maybe haven't utilized the market in a long time, and an example of that was Liberty Mutual having done two ILS transactions in the last year and had taken a pause from the market for a while. And then also the new sponsors that are coming. I think we have a very good shot of exceeding total issuance from last year.
And hopefully a few more Asian domiciled cat bonds to come this year as well.
Exactly. Well, we eagerly read your Artemis sites. You have a great wealth of information and knowledge. So as an industry participant, I do find your information very helpful, and we look forward to reading about those new deals.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Corey. I really appreciate you sharing your insights with us. That was a really great discussion.
Great. Thank you, Steve.